The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got such a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be interviewing celebrity chef Joan Nathan, who has recently written and will be released this week, King Solomon's Table, a culinary exploration of Jewish cooking from around the world, a real ethnography of Jewish cooking. We have a wonderful assortment of Jewish music. The holiday of Passover is coming up in a couple of weeks. It's also the portion of Tzav, which can be found in the book of Leviticus, chapter 6. We have classic, awesome Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Palestinian woman armed with a knife attempted to stab Israeli border police officers outside the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem. Not a good idea. The border guards shot and killed the woman. Israeli security forces stopped a terrorist attack in the West Bank at a bus stop. An Arab terrorist who tried to stab people was overpowered by IDF soldiers and arrested. No shots were fired. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet that, taking into account President Trump's position, Israel will take significant steps to reduce the expansion of the built-up areas of Judea and Samaria. That's what he said on one side of his mouth. On the other side of the mouth, a new community for the residents of Amona was approved at that meeting, so they're expanding settlements in the West Bank. 80% of the gravestones at the 18th century Jewish cemetery of Waldwiese, a village 215 miles east of Paris, were smashed for the second time in 2 years. Three teens were given suspended sentences for the first case 2 years ago. Police are investigating this incident. Israel will withhold another $2 million of its required dues to the UN after the UN's anti-Israel votes. Israel held $7 million in December. Israel pays $11 million to the UN, which will now be used by the foreign ministry to develop relations with countries that are friendly to Israel. And finally, Juan Thompson, who is accused of making 8 bomb threats to JCCs, refused to post bond. Thompson is charged with cyberstalking and will remain in jail in New York City. Meanwhile, the teen accused of making over 150 bomb threats to JCCs around the world will remain in Israeli jail for at least a week. The teen's lawyer showed CAT scans of the teen's brain showing a benign tumor, claiming the tumor affected his behavior. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in a growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Why go anywhere else when you can go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of Passover products in Michigan. One Stop Kosher carries thousands of kosher for Passover items, and over 100 Passover items are on sale now. They even have kosher for Passover pizza, hamburger buns, and cake. One Stop Kosher has the largest selection of kosher for Passover wines as well. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, a little music for your listening pleasures. Brand new. This is Hillel Gross, and the song is Hareini, Here I Am. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have on the line celebrity chef Joan Nathan. Her new cookbook, King Solomon's Table, will be available for purchase this week on coming on Tuesday. So how are you, Joan?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much. First of all, Hamaki Menachem Eschem Esoshar Avali V'Yisrael. You should be comforted among all of the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem, the passing of your mother.
And
Our condolences extend to you. And congratulations on the upcoming wedding of your son.
Oh, so where did... Oh, you must have read the Washington Post.
Indeed. So we come well prepared. So I'm actually stalking you. So so now, King Solomon's Table, very interesting thing. A couple while back, we had Bernard-Henri Lévy on the show. He had written a book called The Genius of Judaism. You can listen to it online at rabbifinman.com. It's actually quite interesting. The purpose of his book, the premise of his book was that France is France because of its Jews, not like the way people had been perceiving before that Jews are French because of France. So I've asked the question of many. We have like about two, three people, authors of cookbooks on the show, and I asked them to talk about Jewish cooking and what defines Jewish cooking. And it seems till now, until I read King Solomon's Table, that Jewish cooking was defined by, well, whatever region Jews happen to be in. But looking at this book, I'm seeing that maybe it's the other way around, that it's the Jewish influences and what the Jews were eating which developed the various styles of culinary consumption. How do you think about that, Joan?
Well, I think it's both. I think that, you know, when I think of French cooking or Italian cooking, I think of cooking with roots. So roots in the land.
You're not talking about rutabagas and beets. You're talking about
R-O-O-T-S, but roots. You know, food that comes from the land where they are, because they didn't move. However, even with Italian and French cooking, there's all kinds of outside influences because people were moving around even in the ancient world. You know, I've been able to track Jewish cooking because I know something about it. But Jewish cooking, as I see it, is defined, first of all, by the dietary laws, no question. And even if you're not religious, in the back of your mind, there's the idea of the dietary laws. And with them comes food-centered meals and the comfort of music and chanting and food. So that's one thing. The second is Jews were always merchants since the time of King Solomon. They went out looking for the new. They went to by sea, by foot on the Silk Road, looking for not just food, but food was sort of a byproduct of the other things they were looking for, like precious stones and jewels. And foods that were portable, like spices and seeds, that kind of thing, they would bring back. So that was the other thing. Then the third is Jews were always expelled, and so they had to adapt. So they would not only bring these new foods with them, but they'd adapt to the countries that they were living in.
That's interesting. My grandmother...
And so they would bring on new foods, but always in line with the dietary laws.
My grandmother, who was very, I would say, a major part of the development of my palate, had a saying, as kartoffel seinen billig, es min kartoffel. As potatoes are cheap, we eat potatoes. So
right, exactly. Exactly.
So it's what was available. And my mother would always say French onion soup is just basically peasant food. They had some onions. They had some old bread. They threw it into a pot, voila, French onion soup. So now the idea of King Solomon's Table, it seems that there's a certain amount of bragging rights. It's to show one's opulence by, like, I don't know about bragging, if you would say it, but really extolling the grandeur of a table. Like recently I came across that Nero was very proud that he could serve every one of his guests 100 oysters. This is like, you know, like who would ever think of such a thing? But it does say in the Talmud, there is this expression that kings, it says, Sudish Shleima Bescheitissa. It says that concerning feeding workers, that it says, if you give a worker, you promise a worker, a day worker, lunch, you have to tell them what they're going to be having for lunch. Because since it is that they're Jewish, they would really expect Sudas Shleima B'Shaitasa, the King Solomon's meal for lunch, and it talks about it. That King
Solomon.
Really? Yes.
Can you tell me? I want that.
It's in Baba Metzia, chapter 6, and that's about all I can do right now. That's about the closest I can get to page number, but I can send you a reference later. But that's the law. It says somebody hired workers, and he said, "What?" I said, "I told Ty." He sent his son, and his son came back and said, "I promised them lunch." He said, "Go back and tell them we're feeding them beans, because otherwise we would have to give them a King Solomon's lunch." And King Solomon's lunch every single day was 20,000 sheep. That was what King Solomon's table was. Such tremendous, like a show that, you know, we're doing really well. So is in Judaism, it comes up to this, you know, I call this idea of gastro-Judaism and feed them and they will come sort of thing. So tell us about this idea of why you call it King Solomon's table and the influence then of, say, the Bible in Jewish cuisine.
Well, I call it King Solomon's table actually precisely because of what you said. I realized that it was his opulence. It wasn't... You wouldn't call King David's table, because first of all, there was no temple. Or a palace like there was for King Solomon. And that he was, you know, even in the Bible, it says that he went out, that he brought back all these wonderful things like spices and other kinds, and that he had huge appetites. Supposedly, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, which is all a show of strength in the ancient world as a ruler. And the concubines, if you've ever been to India or I think in Asia too, these old temples would have at the base of the temple a place for the concubines. So women were considered power. You know, I'm sure that was an exaggeration, but it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. That's what they had.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I thought it was a great metaphor for... And then when I was in... India, I noticed at the synagogue in Cochin, it said that King Solomon's people, not King Solomon, I don't think it was King Solomon, had gotten as far as India.
Mm-hmm. His sphere of influence.
Right.
Makes sense.
So, but also that they were here. And then, you know, I also realized that St. Thomas Aquinas was there, not very, like about the second century.
In India.
So, that was much later. But even so, if he was there then people had been there before. And we know that there was a lot of, for example, sesame seeds were already brought in 1700 B.C. to Babylon from China. So there was a lot of people going back and forth then.
Mm-hmm. And since Jews were so involved with this import-export, so... Naturally.
Right, and Jews have been since, and what happened was, as I see it, you know, there's this one guy he's sort of been convinced by me, okay, who's a Jewish historian in India. There's no sign, like a lot of people don't believe, as you know, in King Solomon. If there's no, and others that do believe in it said that they will find some relic of King Solomon, because they have something of King David. Some people think that he's just really been a metaphor throughout history, the myth of the wise king and all that kind of stuff. But I like to think that there definitely was a King Solomon.
I'm kind of inclined to think that there was a King Solomon as recently, about 7-8 years ago, when they were digging around in the Temple Mount. They came across what was called and known as the Nachal Kidron, which is described as a place where King Solomon was anointed in great detail. It mentions in the Bible, it describes the three steps leading down to this little brook, and they found the whole thing. So I'm kind of inclined that Solomon did exist.
Right. So that for me, it was a metaphor. And my editor, she was the one who came up with the title, King Solomon's Table. The only problem is there's hashtags King Solomon's Table. There's also another site, King Solomon's Table, that's a concubine site. But, he was a sign of good food, and Jews have liked good food throughout history, and they've wandered around the world, and that's what my book is about, with 170 recipes.
Now, indeed, and looking at the influence that Jews had on the palates of their host nations, looking at the commentary written by Rashi in the year around the year 1000, Rashi called Jews the people of the garlic. It came out when the Jews were in the desert and they were eating manna, and they said, "Listen, you know, the manna kind of like, you know, it doesn't taste like garlic," was one of their complaints. "We can't get any garlic out of this thing. It tastes like anything they wanted, but they couldn't get it to taste like garlic, leeks, onions, pumpkins, and squash."
Right.
So Jews are the people of the garlic. When I saw that, the first time I saw that, I said, wait a minute, Italians are the people of the garlic. So who?
No, Jews were known as garlic eaters throughout history. And of course, in the Talmud, it says you have to have a little bit of garlic on Friday night because you wanted to open your sexual prowess. And that was something that did that. And so throughout history, Jews have eaten garlic. But what's so interesting is other ethnic groups have. And it wasn't really until the 1960s that people people didn't want you to eat garlic because it smelled and that you would smell like an immigrant. And of course, that is no longer in this country.
The expression is not that you smelled like garlic, but you smelled like an immigrant. It was like this
right,
stigma
right,
involved
right,
with it.
Garlic, right.
Indeed. It took you a long time to put this cookbook together.
Right.
How many places did you visit that it says that this is a culinary exploration of Jewish cooking from around the world? So how
I went to lots of cities in this country. I went to, I guess, about 30 countries.
That's a lot of countries.
I've worked for 6 years, but some of it I was able to do. Let's say I couldn't get to Azerbaijan. I had a deadline, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get to Uzbekistan because I like to linger when I go to a country. And so I went to Brooklyn. But I did go to India. I'd been to Czechoslovakia, to Italy. I spent a lot of time in Italy. I'd never spent a lot of time in Italy. And I thought because the Jews, after the destruction of the Second Temple, went up through Italy, that Italy was really important. And I think I was absolutely right. The other place, because you get things like carciofi alla Giudea, which is artichokes for Passover. And then you get this wonderful slowly cooked huevos hominados, which is a Sephardic egg with spinach that we now replaces at our Seder, the hard-boiled egg with salt water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just delicious. So, you know, you have to meet people to find these gems of Judaism. And I went to Canada. I went to El Salvador. I went to Cuba. I was in Brazil. Let's see, where else? Argentina.
All over.
I went to a lot of places.
All over. Okay, so one of the things that impressed me was
Russia, Soviet Union.
Indeed.
Yeah, go on.
One of the things that impressed me was that during the time of the Inquisition, people were monitors. If they were secret clandestine Jews, when they had outwardly converted, was by the amount of eggplant they were eating. Tell us about that.
Jews were called eggplant eaters, and it was the Jewish vegetable. It came from China and, it originated in China and India, and then everything came through Mesopotamia. And Jews, of course, were living in Iraq, which is another country I could not visit, but I heard that a lot of the great cooks, Iraqi cooks, were in England, and so I got a lot of Iraqi recipes, but a lot of eggplant recipes from all over. And I could tell there are certain dishes like eggplant bits with fried eggplant with the skin on that were Jewish. And the first time I ate that was in Georgia, Russia. And when I tasted, of course, by the way, I went to Israel a lot, but when I tasted this eggplant, and I got the recipe. I watched the woman cook it, got the recipe. And then I was in Israel, and then I was in Italy, and I had the same dish, different spices. And I realized that Jewish merchants, and they probably were all men, would, from the early, early days, travel and get seeds, bring them home to their wives, who would plant them or have somebody plant them. And they would say, oh, I had this taste of this good dish. And it was an eggplant cut up small and fried with maybe scallions or onions. And sometimes it was with nothing on it. Sometimes it was spices, but they would put their own spices, and that's how people, recipes changed. And then eventually when tomatoes came in, it became like caponata, or even before that in Italy. And eventually, similar, a little bit larger, it became ratatouille once zucchini were developed, and when tomatoes and peppers were from the New World. So you can see how eggplant recipes developed, and it was there was in Florence a very influential food writer basically called it disgusting Jewish food, eggplants.
Indeed. Okay, so it seems like all the stuff that Jews were introducing to Europe were all coming from other places, because the Jews were moving in migrations from one place to the other. Weren't there any indigenous food in Europe that the Europeans were eating?
Oh, yeah, they were all eating, well, they had spinach, which came, again, from, I think Alexander the Great brought it from Persia to Greece. But people were eating that early on. They were eating, Swiss chard. They were eating beef in Europe early mm-hmm. on. In the Middle East, they were eating mostly. There was some beef, but they were eating lambs and goats. The beans they were eating were fava beans. And of course, Jews couldn't always digest some Jews from the Middle East, so some people could die from what's called fava-ism.
Oh, really?
So they would eat chickpeas, which is very, very old, 12,000 years ago. And wine was cheaper than water,
and probably healthier at that point too.
Right. 1750 BC. There's a site in Israel that has wine. The largest wine cellar, I think, in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest today is celebrity chef Joan Nathan. Her new cookbook, King Solomon's Table, is soon to be released, very soon.
Tuesday.
Tuesday, indeed. Now, biblically speaking, chickens are disgusting little creatures. They're in the temple services, for example, when they were using a bird, they either used a young pigeon or an adult turtle dove. And it specifically says in all the books not to use chickens because they are such dirty, horrible little birds. Yet, as soon as you think about anything having to do with Jewish food, the first thing that comes up is chicken soup. So,
yeah, but it wasn't, but not early. It wasn't early on. In fact, the rabbis during the rabbinical period thought that the chicken was a dirty animal because the feet, you know, they just wandered around all the time and were pecking everything. So early on, they were using other birds, it was later. And I personally think it started, the idea of chicken was started in Babylon,
mm-hmm.
using it because they were cultivated there earlier. It was a more sophisticated city, and yeah, and I think that they would eat things like a form of, like a stew, or what later became challenge, with either lamb or sometimes beef, but either mostly lamb or goat, and fava beans or chickpeas. There were no potatoes then, onions, mm-hmm. garlic.
Understood. Okay, so now, much of Jewish eating revolves around preparing or eating on the Sabbath, which is supposed to be like the big day of the week, and also on the holidays. So going around the world, do you see like certain points of compare and contrast as far as holiday preparations, Joan?
Mm-hmm. That would say that again?
Do you see there's a major focus on food preparations for the Sabbath, for Shabbos, and for the various holidays? And as Jews have migrated and find themselves around the world, do you see various points of comparison and contrast within the preparation of foods for those holidays?
Well, you know, first of all, you're going to eat different foods because you're going to live in different places. And also people that are religious will have a different preparation, certainly with Passover. You know, you'll spend weeks really cleaning your house, ridding it of everything that, you know, any kind of flour, any kind of fermented food. I mean, you know, I'm not that religious, but I get rid of all that stuff. And it's a game when my kids were little that they'd look at all the boxes to see what we couldn't use. And then, you know, what you eat will be different, too, and what you can eat. And then with mixed marriages especially in Israel, with Sephardic and Ashkenazi, you know, different kinds of Sephardic, there's all kinds. Sometimes it's side-by-side food. Sometimes it's mixed food. Sometimes it's food that will disappear.
Okay, so where do you see now? We're talking historically now. So do you see like a progression as to where Jewish food is going to be? Because we do have different influences still influencing us. And yes, we are getting things like lox and cream cheese sushi. You should pardon the expression. Where do you think Jewish food is headed now, if you would like put it on a timeline?
Well, you know, somebody just told me about these rainbow bagels, which to me sounded awful. I think it's headed back to purity. You know, we're using dishes with chickpeas, which were what they used during the myth of Gilgamesh in the ancient world. We're using a lot more chickpeas, which we're going to have to in the world that we live in, where there's going to be a bigger drought because they're drought resistant. And on the other hand, there's all this I consider kind of silly food, like these rainbow bagels that are just over the top. You know, that they're fun, but they're, to me, not so interesting. I just like really good recipes. You know, like, I found this wonderful blueberry schritzlach in Toronto. It's a blueberry dish that I'd never heard of. They call it blueberry buns. It was from Southwest Holland, and I found that the woman who brought them over came between the wars, and then another woman who was making them was also between the wars, and I realized that a recipe like this was an oblong dough, buttery dough, with blueberries from the summer, fresh blueberries put in it and made like, in a way, the way we do a blueberry muffin in this country. And it's very, very popular in Toronto. And when I was making it, a girl came to my house, and I said, look, I'm testing this recipe. She said, my grandma made it. And her grandmother was 30 miles from the woman who made it in Toronto, who had a bakery. And then I learned that my friend's grandmother lived in Skokie, Illinois, and the other and the recipe, these were all religious Jews. So when the Nazis came in, they were all wiped out. Therefore, this recipe would never have been there. Mm-hmm. If these women hadn't come for the war. And it's a great recipe. It's mm-hmm. in the book. And, you know, there are all these stories about all these such wonderful recipes that are real, that you don't have to keep trying to make sushi bagels or whatever you want to make. Just buy
that sounds
book.
Awful. Okay. Would you say that there's something with the development, like you point out to a restaurant recipe, this recipe is Babylonian, this recipe is Italian, this recipe is French. Would you say that there are any Jewish food that you would call now uniquely American, Joan Nathan?
Well, big bagels, challah French toast. Let's see. The kind of chocolate babka that's everywhere.
That's American, really.
All
okay.
Larger, richer, very sweet challah. Nobody had that sweet challah. Aerated challah that mm-hmm. you get at most bakeries. Brisket that we have, that's from big cuts that are cut through the bone. You don't find that anyplace else. It's all, you know, manufactured for us.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Now, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I have to ask, and I ask this for everybody who's involved with ethnographies and cooking and whatnot. My grandmother on Purim which she was a terrible baker, first of all. The only thing that she baked was she made these sugar cookies, that she called them sugar cookies, but you could mm-hmm. you could use them as projectiles, maybe like discs for like skeet shooting. They were unbelievably bad. But she also made hamantaschen, which were absolutely wonderful. She made a variety of hamantasch, which she called a pieryszki. I don't know if you've heard the word pieryszki. She was from northern uh-huh. Poland. And what it was the same type of dough, cookie dough type thing. And the filling was made out of a mixture of roasted beets, chopped walnuts, and honey. And that's what she made the hamantaschen with. And then she would dip the whole thing in honey. So have you ever come across such a thing?
Yeah, these are old recipes, and they're they're much better than anything you can find today. And there's a good fruit filling in King Solomon's Table. So I hope everybody will buy it and enjoy it.
Indeed. Okay, our guest today has been Joan Nathan. She has just coming out with King Solomon's Table. It is published by Knopp Publishing, available wherever one would procure a cookbook. I want to thank you so much for coming on our show again and wish you continued success and a happy and a healthy Passover.
Thank you. Same to you. Okay. I hope I'll come to Detroit because I would love to.
Oh, it would be our pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Hey, Shel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Now I'm hungry. Anyway, for your listening pleasure, just to change the tone a little bit, speaking of tone, this song is called The Eighth Note. I think this song was written a long time ago. I didn't see any provenance. I seem to remember seeing it like 20 or something years ago. But it's newly released. The artist is new on the block. His name is Levi Cohen. Let's listen.
Our voices ringing loud and strong.
someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. And now for something completely different. This is Mickey Katz and his rendition of Tico Tico, which he calls Tickle Tickle.
Señores and señoritas, schnorrers and schnorreritas. Babin, you say that you are still a vista of a stair, si has been held, stop, caption is like a yes. Caramba, si de bamba ya moi, may she pipi tweeta la switchy. Leifster, 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 Leifster. Arriva, arriva, Buenos Blitzes, got the choice, say she schmidt and a whole mirakange. You tickle me, I tickle you, you tickle me, I tickle you, get stuck on that. I shame this doom, and I'll take who's saying you need time, a dog of that. It's my heart you tame, yes, tickle hair in the baby, I'm jealous of a canna. You look so nice, tickle stickle eyes, the mice of Anahana, the manana. Let me sit up, see later, open it, up, back to the Columbus. My devilish man, look up, and van tatty yachts, hasta la bagel. Did give stun, not husband, there, you got just a giant there. She's pretty big, I'm a pickle, come so happy, I will always tickle tickle.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Why go anywhere else when you go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of Passover products in Michigan. One Stop Kosher carries thousands of kosher for Passover items, and over 100 Passover items are on sale now. They even have kosher for Passover pizza, hamburger buns, and cake. One Stop Kosher has the largest selection of kosher for Passover wines as well. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Herr Schulfenman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Tzav, which is to be found in Leviticus chapter 6 and following. And we happen to be about 10 days or so before Passover at this point, less. Today's the 6th. So Passover is the 15th. So we're 9 days from Passover. The first Seder is a week from tomorrow night. So, and continuing with the vein of thought, which we started 2 weeks ago, post-Purim, that the portions that we are reading now are preparation, spiritual and psychological, preparation for Passover. What's the one in the portion of Tzav? It starts out with something called Terumas Hadeshen, which means the ash offering, that every single day, before, way before dawn, the Kohanim, the priests, would get up and they'd get their little rubber squeegees and they would squeegee the top of the altar, gathering together all the remaining embers and piles of ashes that had been left to burn overnight, and it would pile it all up into the middle of the altar, into a huge pile. And every day they would take like a handful of ash and throw it off the side of the altar, and it said it would disappear, which wasn't really too hard because it's just a handful of ash. And the altar at that point was about 60 feet high off the ground, so it never ever hit the ground per se as a handful of ash. Every 60 or 70 years old, this pile of ash, which was called the tapuach, the apple, because it looked like a half an apple sitting face down or cut side down, it's a big semicircle, they would take away about half of it and go bury it in a proper Jewish burial type place. Not necessarily a graveyard, but a place which was sanctified specifically for the burial of 60 years, or in this case, 30 or 40 years of ashes that had been put there. What do we know from that? What do we learn from that? We're not doing Bible as history. We're not doing Bible as trivia, God forbid. But rather, Bible as lesson. So the first thing that happens before we start our day is we say, our eyes pop open, sort of. Mine kind of sort of like just like creak open. And the first words out of my mouth are usually, but I try not to, is, oh no. But here we go again. No, the first thing that comes out of a Jew's mouth is, Moda ani lifanecha, I admit before you, Melech Chai v'kayim, living and eternal king, Shehechazarta b'nish mosi, that you have returned my soul, Rabba emunasecha, great is your faith, meaning in me. So the first thing that we're doing, just as at the very onset of our day-to-day life, is acknowledging God's presence. Before we've gotten out of bed, before we've pushed our head off the pillow even, very first thing. And what are we doing? We're telling ourselves we're starting with a clean slate. Today's going to be a better day than tomorrow. And yes, as it says in the Code of Jewish Law, I am going to start today with alacrity and courage and go and attack the world and make the world a better place. To what degree? Well, I got all the schmutz, all the ashes, all the leftovers from yesterday. I got them all into a pile. And not only that, but I've dedicated it. I've made it something holy. So what was left over yesterday as my end point of holiness, today is my starting point for holiness. That's what Passover is. With Passover, it's the birth of the Jewish people, yes. But the word Mitzrayim means, Egypt, means also limitations. So that a person every single day is going out of their personal Egypt, their personal limitations. That tomorrow's, I did this, is today's, that's where I'm starting from. Not to say I'm happy with what I did yesterday. No. If the Almighty had faith in you, that today you're awake, it means there's something new and exciting for you. And that's what we're here for. Speaking of here for, let's take a quick commercial break, and we're going to come back with the Hasidic story. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com. You'll find the contact page right on the homepage. We'll have to look around. You'll also find archived editions of the show. I made reference before to an interview with Bernard-Henri Lévy. Well, if you missed that one, I suggest that was award-winning, if you ask me. Go back on the website. Go back a couple of weeks until you come up to the one that says Bernard-Henri Lévy. And it doesn't necessarily have to say it in front with a French accent. And you can click, you can listen. And there's about a year and a half worth of shows right there ready for your listening pleasure. There's also archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story, classes. They're all there. Ways of making Judaism exciting, entertaining, fun, just for you. There's also, speaking of entertaining, exciting, and fun, there's the donations page. I love the donations page. It's so fun. You just go to it, you click on it, you enter. If you have a PayPal account, 30 seconds later, you are done. And you can even make it such. You click the little button in PayPal, and it happens once a month. So don't think that you can't afford to give to the Jewish Hour. You could. You could give $5 a month. Here it is. You're listening to the show. $5 a month comes out to $1.20 per show. And that's really, really, really affordable. So you spend twice as much on a coffee at Starbucks. I mean, you know, and that's just a little one with no milk in it even. So what's $1.25? So $5 a month, do that. That's $60 a year. That's great. So, and I've promised that if people would indeed contribute enough to pay for the month, well, this is the 31st. So, well, next week we're starting April already, but it's still the 31st. And you can still get it in. Actually, it's the beginning of April. But if you didn't make the $36 for the membership, we'll send us $36. We'll let it slide. And we'll send you a CD. And thank you very much for becoming part of the Jewish Hour family. Story. There was a person called the B'nai Yisachar. He turned out to be grew up to be a very big rabbi living in Poland. And when he was a kid, about 10 years old, his father had to hire himself as a teacher, which meant that he was away from September to April because he was teaching these people someplace, somewhere. It happened to be located in the middle of no place. He was teaching innkeeper's two children. And the way the story goes, these kids had head like bricks. They were really, wasn't fun. But there was a tremendous snowstorm. And in the tremendous snowstorm, three Russian peasants banged on the door. We need some place to stay. The blizzard is too much. We'll die. And he said, "Do you have got any money?" They said, "No, we haven't any money." He said, "Sorry, I'm an innkeeper. I make money. Goodbye." So the teacher, the father, was like appalled. So the innkeeper said to him, "Are you going to pay for their bill?" He said, "I'll pay their bill." So the storm lasted, before they could get out, 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, they left and they thanked their host. They thanked the teacher and went on their way. Came now time for Passover and a time to settle up. The innkeeper said, "I owe you 40 rubles. You owe me 43 rubles. Have a nice Passover. Bring the 3 rubles back when you come back after Passover." So here it is. He doesn't have any money. And he's walking back to his town. Finally, he gets to town. And he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have any money. And it's like, what am I going to do? My wife has no food. So his son had heard that his father had come to town. And he ran to where his father is. And he says, "Please, father, come home. We have the tailor to pay. And mom got his new shoes. And we have all the food for Passover." As they're walking back, a carriage passed by them and hit a rut. And a box fell off the back of the carriage. Inside it was 43 rubles. Imagine that. And they tried to chase down the wagon driver, but the wagon disappeared. That Passover night, the next following, there's a scene where we open the door for Elijah the prophet. And the tradition is, if there's anybody there, it's Elijah the prophet. And so this young 10-year-old opened the door and said, "Dad, the wagon driver is here." But there wasn't anybody there. The father called him over and said, "Don't tell anybody this story until you're on your deathbed." This story was told to one of his students, who told it to the rabbi that got me involved with Judaism. That's it. We're going to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Take care.